Welcome to this Essential Knowledge Update podcast from the Royal College of General Practitioners. I'm Dr. Sally Higginbottom, and today I'm interviewing Dr. Kevin Barrett. He's Chair of the Primary Care Society for Gastroenterology, and he's the RCGP Crohn's and Colitis Spotlight Project Clinical Lead. And of course, he's also a GP working in Hertfordshire. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, Sally.
This is a module based on new NICE guidance on ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Why have we got new guidance?
Ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, it's one of those diseases where we know that there's an increase in prevalence of it, and there's been more research going on to say actually there are more and more patients that have been affected with it. The prevalence in countries that are becoming westernized is increasing all the time, maybe leveling off in our post-industrialized parts of the world too. Lots of new treatments are available as well. They're using biologic treatments at a much earlier stage than they used to as well. So I think NICE felt it was time for an update in those areas.
Interesting that it seems to be an industrialized nation's disease. Any thoughts as to why that might be?
Oh, it's multifactorial. I think there's no one particular thing that triggers it off. It's something to do with a combination of genetics plus an environmental factor. And again, what that environmental factor is, nobody really knows for sure, whether it's an infective agent or a lifestyle agent or a whole range of different things. There's lots of research going on into it at the moment. But multifactorial, I think, is the key word that we use when talking about the causes of inflammatory bowel disease.
So what symptoms might patients present with?
And in general practice, we see patients who come in with that classic triad of weight loss, abdominal pain and diarrhea, then it can be very straightforward. The problem is that not every patient presents with those symptoms, and the symptoms can come on very gradually. We hear about patients that have been diagnosed with other conditions for years before they end up getting a diagnosis of Crohn's or colitis, and the symptoms come on quite insidiously. Atypical symptoms are quite common as well, particularly in children. So we know that around about 44% of children don't get any change in their bowel habits. They just get tiredness, failure to thrive, anemia, those sorts of things as well. And there's a whole host of extra-intestinal symptoms that can also occur. So it can be really tricky to diagnose.
And just going back to medical school times, ulcerative colitis is always continuous from the rectum proximately through the bowel, whereas Crohn's has lesions at any point, right from the mouth, right down to the anus. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. There can occasionally be a bit of overlap, but on the whole, ulcerative colitis just generally affects the left side of the bowel. So you can just get a proctitis, just at the last few centimetres of the bowel, or it can extend all the way around. So you get a pancolitis, and it only affects the inner wall of the bowel. Whereas Crohn's disease gives you more of a patchy inflammation that can affect anywhere from the mouth down to the anus. And so you get some patients who just get mouth ulcers, some patients get small bowel disease, and some patients get large bowel disease, but you get patchy ulcers and skip lesions. And the thing about Crohn's disease, it can affect all the lining of the bowels, and just the inner wall, the muscle, all the way through to the outside. So you can get strictures, fistures, fistulas, scarring, all sorts of other problems with it too.
And you mentioned that there are extra intestinal symptoms, so non-gut symptoms. There's obviously quite a long list of these, but what are the key things that you think we should remember?
I think that word inflammatory bowel disease, I think that's probably a bit of a misnomer, because it's not just about inflammation in the bowel. It's a multi-system inflammatory condition. The general bits that they can affect outside the bowel tend to be the skin, the eyes, the liver and the joints. And we think about our list of differential diagnoses when you see a patient with erythema nodosum, and inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's colitis should be on that list of possibilities when we see that.
Looking at the module, both diseases have two main age groups for diagnosis: young adults, to maybe 15 and 30, and then older adults, 50 to 70. The youngsters I was aware of, and it's high up on my list to think of, but I wasn't so much aware with older adults.
Again, it's one of those conditions that can affect anyone of any age. There have been babies diagnosed under a year old, and people in their 90s who are diagnosed with it as well. The classic patients that we see tend to be those in their late teens, 20s, 30s, that sort of age group as well. But there is certainly another peak that occurs later in life as well. And some of those might be an issue called microscopic colitis, which is a slightly different condition to Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, but some organisations group it together as an inflammatory bowel disease. I think there's a lot of research going on as well into the genetic causes as well. And certainly we know that the different groups, the different populations or different subtypes of Crohn's disease particularly tend to have different genetic patterns with them too.
Particularly in younger adults, IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, is often the main differential diagnosis if someone's coming in with abdominal pain and diarrhea. How can you decide which you're likely to be dealing with?
The problem with IBD and IBS is the symptoms do overlap a lot, and it doesn't really help that those initials are very, very similar. IBS is a functional bowel problem where there's been no physical pathology as yet diagnosed, although research is definitely going on into that. Weight loss, fevers, night sweats, and getting up at night to actually open the bowel is probably the key parts. Because we know that patients with IBS, on the whole, they can have very troublesome symptoms during the day, but once they're asleep, then generally the bowels are quite quiescent and don't disturb them. Whereas patients without Crohn's and colitis, They're often waking up at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning because they have to get up and go for a poo. And if they don't, then they're at risk of actually soiling the bed. So nighttime problems are definitely a question that's worth asking to our patients.
That's really helpful. Where do we start with investigations?
As always in medicine, a good history and a thorough physical examination is always important. It's we need to put our hand on our patients' tummies and feel for masses as well, because the symptoms can overlap with ovarian cancer and colorectal cancer too. But when we're doing our investigations, then we'd start with the basic blood tests. So a full blood count, inflammatory markers, so a CRP, maybe an ESR. It's also worth thinking about celiac disease, because again, it can overlap with those symptoms. We know that celiac disease is probably underdiagnosed in the UK. And it's probably also worth checking for a thyroid screen as well. The other thing that's worth thinking about as well is that patients who present with IBS type symptoms, particularly women over the age of 50, a nice MG12 tells us to think about ovarian cancer in that age group. And so it might be worth adding a CA125 to the blood tests, unless it's very obviously going to be a bloody diarrhea type symptom. But when you're not sure, could this be IBS? Could it be Crohn's or colitis? Then those are sorts of blood tests that I would normally recommend people do.
The thing that seems to have changed my practice in this area is the faecal calprotectin stool test, which I found incredibly helpful in differentiating inflammatory bowel diseases and other sorts of disease. How do you find it?
Calprotectin has definitely transformed practice. It's only been around for the last few years, and almost every GP now has access to it in primary care. There still might be some patches around the UK where it's a bit troublesome to access as well. But calprotectin, yeah, it's a calcium binding protein released by inflammation. So you can test levels in any bodily fluid. But when you test it in feces, then it actually shows that there's inflammation inside the bowel. It's not a perfect test, as with lots of things. You can get false negatives and false positives. So in children, for example, in patients who've got small bowel disease, they might have a negative result. And again, patients with microscopic colitis, that their results might be negative too. And you can get false positives, particularly patients with any sort of infective cause or colorectal cancer can give you raised levels. And also patients taking decent amounts of non-steroidals can give you a false positive. But it's a really useful screening test and can certainly help us differentiate between those patients who need further investigation and those that we can probably initially manage in primary care. It's not a diagnostic test, that's the key. And I think in order to get a proper diagnosis of Crohn's or colitis, one still needs to go off and have an endoscopy with biopsies in almost every case.
But this helps us screen out a lot of people who might not need that. And I've also found, as you say, people who've been diagnosed with IBS for years, actually a calprotectin can sometimes be the moment where you think, actually this is not IBS, this is something that needs to see secondary care.
Absolutely. Crohn's and Colitis UK, I certainly hear lots of stories from patients who had IBS for a long time and then things change and the symptoms become slightly different. And I think with any patient who's got a long-term condition or long-term label on their record, if they come in and their symptoms are slightly different from normal and their bowel habits are a bit different or they're developing new symptoms, it's definitely always worth us going back and rethinking things and thinking, actually, is that now still the right diagnosis? Have they developed something else that's similar to it as well? Because we know patients with IBS, they certainly can go on to develop Crohn's or colitis or colorectal cancer. So yeah, a calprotectin in that situation is definitely worth considering.
Most treatment will be managed in secondary care, but broadly speaking, what treatment options would we expect in Crohn's or in UC?
So Crohn's disease, because it's a condition that affects lots of different areas of the bowel on the whole, the treatments tend to be systemic for it. The aims of the treatment with Crohn's and ulcerative colitis really are to get the mucosal healing sorted out and to relieve the symptoms. I think the reason for getting mucosal healing is that we know that actually there's an association between having good mucosal healing and reduced chance of having flares and also reducing the chance of colorectal cancer happening too. You can start steroids. So steroids have been used for a long, long time and they're great at relieving the symptoms and relieving the inflammation that goes on as well. But steroids, they're rubbish long term. We know we've all had patients who've been on steroids long term and developed osteoporosis and mood disorders and all sorts of problems as well. So steroids are not great for long term use. Crohn's disease, again, disease modifying treatments. Azathioprine is used as a main treatment for Crohn's disease. You can also use methotrexate in Crohn's disease, not quite as often. But the biologic drugs are actually transformed a lot of treatments for both sorts of inflammatory bowel disease. And these are drugs that actually do directly affect the immune system in a targeted way, in the same way that they're used for rheumatoid arthritis and psoriatic arthritis, those sorts of conditions as well. And they're being used more and more often in the treatment of Crohn's disease.
And practically speaking, for those, patients tend to go up to the hospital for infusions every however many weeks. Is that right?
They do. I'm not aware of anywhere at the moment that where primary care is initiating monitoring or looking after those patients. So that's definitely still very secondary care orientated. But, you know, who knows what's going to happen over the next decade or so.
And in ulcerative colitis, because it's often quite a distal disease, sometimes there's more local treatments with enemas. Is that right?
because the disease can be limited to the left side, particularly the distal end. There are a range of different treatments you can use for that, and topical treatments. So, yep, suppositories or enemas, they can be used much more effectively as well. So you don't have to have that systemic effect as well. And also, for those patients who've got more extensive disease or where those topical treatments don't work, then mesalazines, 5-ASAs, can be really effective in ulcerative colitis, whereas the evidence is that they don't really work very well in Crohn's disease. So patients can end up on a combination of an enema and a suppository and taking mesalazine tablets as well in ulcerative colitis. So you can often get a more complicated treatment regime in ulcerative colitis, but it's always important to make sure when we are asked to prescribe particular therapies that we try and get the therapies that match what secondary care have asked us to do because of the release profiles and the areas of the bowel that they affect, just to make sure that we do get that targeted treatment right for that patient.
So these might be things we have to prescribe by brand rather than generically at times, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely, some of them. So there are certain medications that are branded because of the preparations released in different areas of the bowel. And if you're using topical treatments as well, that they kind of reach up to different distances within the rectum compared to others as well. So you have to be a little bit more careful when prescribing those.
So when we see our patients who've got ulcerative colitis or Crohn's, are there any other symptoms we can help with in primary care?
Yeah, I mean, secondary care are fantastic. They've got brilliant inflammatory bowel disease nurses, have a huge amount of experience in dealing with all sorts of things, and they can be brilliant at dealing with fatigue and work and contraception and pregnancy and fertility and all those sorts of things as well. But obviously, there are only so many of them, and there are lots of patients that have it, and lots of patients maybe don't have disease that requires them to be going regularly back to secondary care. So patients who've been on treatment for a long time that have got sort of milder symptoms that don't particularly have an IBD nurse, and some areas of the country don't have them either. So as GPs, I think it's our role to have that holistic approach to patients and think about all those things. So contraception is really important. So patients with small bowel disease and Crohn's and a rapid bowel transit time, we need to think about, is oral contraception the right thing for them? Should they be having an implant or something different instead because of that risk of pregnancy in that group? Are they anemic because absorption of iron can be really poor if you've got small bowel disease, or you might be making dietary changes that mean you're avoiding certain foods. Low calcium levels, vitamin D, all of those things can be affected by it as well. So I think having that slightly more holistic approach, as GPs generally know our patients better when we get continuity, we can think about those sorts of things too. And again, work is really important because we've got patients who go to work and they manage their journey to work and they get to work and they sit in an office and they've got access to toilets and things. But if they're sitting in meetings, they might need to leave meetings with short notice, or if they're doing jobs, that means they can't leave. So the examples I always give are midwives. So if midwife's looking after a woman in labour, she can't just disappear and leave and go off to the loo in the middle of looking after that patient. Or we've got patients on building sites. So again, always whenever I see a building site with a tower crane, I think about the poor guy sitting at the top of the tower crane. I'm thinking if they had Crohn's or colitis, how would they manage to access toilets as well? I think that's our role as GPs, to think about those sorts of things.
The other time we often get involved is when someone's coming in with a bit of a relapse where they've got a flare of their symptoms. How do we assess how severe things are?
Flares can be very tricky. I think the key thing is to listen to the patient, because often the patients have had the disease a long time. They know when they're having a true flare versus a flare of their symptoms. There's a lot of discussion out there about what actually a flare means, because you can have a flare of the symptoms versus a flare of the inflammation. And the flare of the symptoms, lots of patients with Crohn's colitis get IBS-type symptoms that can be triggered by stress and foods and life and all those sorts of things that trigger off IBS in everybody, versus the actual inflammatory flares where there's proper disease process going on as well. It can be very difficult to tell the difference sometimes. So it's always worth getting some objective evidence that there is a flare going on, and calprotectin can be used in those situations, although, again, not every area lets us do calprotectin tests in patients over 40. And also, it can take a couple of weeks to get a calprotectin result back, unless you're lucky enough to have near-patient testing calprotectin kits, which are available, but they're not widely available yet. So it's certainly worth doing physical examination just to assess for any other illness that's going on. Think about infective causes, because patients with Crohn's and colitis, they can get food poisoning and traveler's diarrhea as well. And then it's just worth checking some blood, so doing a full blood count and again, a CRP or ESR, just to get some objective evidence before we start escalating treatment, particularly before we start giving our patients extra doses of steroids.
And if you have someone who's quite unwell with a flare, how do you work out whether they need to go to hospital or not?
Yeah, we know there's still mortality that happens with flares of Crohn's and colitis disease. It varies, I think, between 1 to 2 to 3%, depending which bit of evidence you look at, of mortality from a flare. So the risk is definitely there. I think using our general clinical acumen is worth doing. There are various rating scales you can use, the Truelove and Witt criteria, for example. But generally, actually looking at a patient and thinking, are they septic? Are they hypotensive, tachycardic? Have they got a fever? Have we got any blood results back that can give us evidence for them being unwell? Those are the sorts of things to look for. Frequency of stool is often used as a marker, but again, it varies from patient to patient too. And it can be quite tricky sometimes because those patients who deteriorate very rapidly, it's often easier to say, yes, this person's poorly, they need to go in. Whereas those patients whose disease fluctuates in a much more long-term time scale, you think, well, actually, at what point do we decide to send them into hospital? And patients that have in that condition tend to adjust their life and get used to certain set of symptoms. They feel rubbish, but they don't feel unwell. And working out where the tipping point is, at which point they need to be sent in for some intravenous steroids or those sorts of things can be quite tricky in some situations. And sometimes patients can consciously or subconsciously be in denial about how ill they are too. So it can be difficult to choose that point where the patient needs to go and get that secondary care.
The other thing we are often involved in is a long-term monitoring, particularly of medications for these patients. What do we do in primary care?
So long-term monitoring, again, there should be a shared care agreement in place for the disease-modifying drugs. Patients on biologic treatments are always looked after by secondary care. We may not know about them. I think it's definitely worth us recording in our notes that they're on their biologic treatments because there can be issues with them and immunosuppression and vaccination, live vaccine, for example. That's one thing that we need to know about, particularly mums. And then the babies come to us for the rotavirus vaccination. And if we don't know that the mum has been on a biologic medication, we may inadvertently give that child rotavirus vaccination, which is contraindicated. And the same with nasal flu and yellow fever, those sorts of things. So vaccination is really important. I think making sure the patient's psychological well-being is there and very well looked after is important, because with any chronic inflammatory process, we know that actually there are physical effects because the interleukins and cytokines pass through the blood-brain barrier and actually increase your likelihood of getting depression and anxiety, let alone the pure psychological effect of actually having a long-term condition diagnosed when you're maybe 20 or 30 and you're starting a family and a career and all those sorts of things as well. Cancer screening is really important. So again, it's definitely worth us making sure that our patients are plugged into the hospital's review process. NICE has lots of guidance about when patients should start their screening for cancer, and we've risk stratified into low risk, medium risk, high risk groups as well. BSG have updated that guidance. NICE still says it should start 10 years after diagnosis, but lots of areas are actually starting that at 8 years now, and that's what the British Society of Gastroenterology have said too. But that's generally a secondary care responsibility. But in patients in that age group, you're at university, starting career, moving around the UK, you may get lost to follow-up. So it's worth us as GPs just bearing that in the back of mind, thinking, actually, has this patient had the right colorectal cancer screening done? So yes, a whole range of different things that we can do in primary care for our patients. It's not just something that we hand over to secondary care and let them deal with entirely.
What would your key take-home messages be from this new guidance?
So I think the key is just to bear inflammatory bowel disease in your mind when you're seeing patients with lower abdominal symptoms. Just think, actually, could this be IBD, and actually make sure that we're doing the right investigations for it as well. Also, just remember just to reassess patients who come to us with their symptoms, because particularly patients with IBS, just think about them actually, is this actually IBS? Have things changed? Could it be something else? Could it be celiac disease? Could they be developing colorectal cancer? Could they actually have Crohn's or colitis as well, particularly when their symptoms are different from their normal symptoms? And I think the other message really is for us just to listen to our patients. They know their symptoms. They know what's going on in their lives. They know what's important to them. But always try and get objective evidence if they might be having symptoms that we might think is a flare. And I think the final point really is actually just to use our IBD nurses and our secondary care teams. They'll often have advice lines or email addresses that we can contact for as well. They are fantastic. They look after patients so well. Crohn's Class UK have a fantastic IBD nurse map on their website. Just search for it on the internet. Put in your postcode and it'll tell the contact details of your IBD team and when to expect a call back from them if you do get in touch with them too. So yeah, this is about partnership between patients, primary care and secondary care.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you for your time, Kevin. And thank you for listening to this podcast from the RCGP.